Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The Underdog Podcast from SB Nation and Underdog Dynasty.
Welcome to another edition of the Conference USA Underdog Podcast here on UnderdogDynasty.com, SB Nation's home for G5 football. We just wrapped Conference Championship Week, so have a lot to talk about. Had a great game between UAB and Middle Tennessee that we'll talk about. And it's bowl season. The coaching carousel is continuing to spin wildly, so we'll get into that. Programming note, for the last couple weeks, we've had some issues getting the shows to iTunes, so if that's your preferred method of listening to these, do apologize. Working on getting that fixed very shortly. Hopefully this one will make it up there as well and not just be on the site and on my personal SoundCloud, which I'm pretty sure I've just about exhausted my free minutes of anyway. But anyway, before I ramble too much about whatever nonsense this is, I'm Joe Lonergan, Western Kentucky Conference USA blogger over at UDD.com, joined by Mr. Eric Henry, as always. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing all right, Joe. Cannot complain. Coming off of a busy football weekend, had a chance to cover the American Conference Championship. That was pretty exciting, but good to be back home with the Conference USA, ready to talk a little football.
Awesome. And that's one thing that we can kind of talk about a little bit now. Watching the American Championship on TV with UCF and Memphis, it was such a weird contrasting atmosphere between what was happening in Orlando in terms of the fan support and the environment that that game created versus what was going on in Murfreesboro. It was like night and day. There was a very disappointing turnout in terms of fans for that Conference USA Championship game.
Well, and, you know, Joe, I'm not necessarily going to disagree because obviously it's a conference championship. Middle Tennessee fought back, you know, to host that game at home. Mm-hmm. All things considered, you'd like a better presence. But I think that's almost like comparing an apple to a pomegranate in the sense that think about what UCF, what they were coming off of, you know, the really emotional injury to Mackenzie Milton. Of course, they have the 24 at the time, 24 game winning streak that they were heading into. So I think that's a little bit of an unfair comparison. Although I don't disagree with you. It's a conference championship, and you'd like to see a better crowd. But what I walked into, and you know, for those of you listening, you may or may not know that I am a graduate of UCF, so I'm familiar with the program. But you know, that was a different atmosphere than the 4 years I spent there, just because of the seriousness of the injury to Mackenzie Milton. All of the fans were wearing lays. They actually had lays for all of the media members as well on their chairs inside the press box. So that was pretty funny. But I just think that's a little bit of a tough comparison, because no matter what, that was going to be a huge turnout in Orlando Saturday.
I mean, sure. It's less me saying Conference USA should be that type of atmosphere, and me more saying I hope it one day gets to that type of atmosphere.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah, because I totally understand with how great of a job the University of Central Florida has done in terms of building fan support over the last few years. I one day hope to see a program in Conference USA do something similar. That's really more of the point of what I'm saying, I guess.
Of course. And as someone who, you know, covers FIU, I won't belabor the point about their fan support. It seems like the fan support at FIU is more or less indicative of what you see around a lot of Conference USA, which is you have a very passionate, vocal fan base, but it's not necessarily the biggest.
Sure.
And yeah, you'd like to see that grow.
Yeah, and hopefully if we get more games like what we saw in this Conference USA Championship, hopefully we get more of that, because UAB and Middle Tennessee turned in, I would say, one of the better games of the entire season, really. The Blazers, of course, pulled that one out 27-25, and UAB, just a few years after being shut down completely, rise from the ashes and are Conference USA championships. I would not be surprised if the party is still raging down in Birmingham as we record this. Once this goes up, they might be petering out a little bit, but never say never, I guess. Anyway, really what I thought was going to happen in this game is if UAB wanted to win, they were going to have to keep Brent Stock still off the field. And they struggled with that a little bit at the beginning, but right around the second quarter is when they started being able to do that really well. Spencer Brown, phenomenal day for him, 156 yards and a touchdown on 31 carries. Tyler Johnston, 9 of 15, passing for 140 yards with a touchdown and interception. Johnston also had 56 rushing yards and a rushing touchdown on the day. And I was really impressed with how Tyler Johnston played, just in terms of he was really playing like his team's lives depended on it, if that makes sense. Was running with a lot of heart, got the yardage he needed to when they were up against the wall, especially in the first half there. And Brent Stockstill, not a bad day for him, 29 of 45, 362 passing yards, two touchdowns, two interceptions. But of course, the thing that people are going to be talking about from this game for a while, the play at the very end where UAB is about to punt to give Middle a chance to go back ahead with about a minute left, and the Blue Raiders get whistled for an illegal substitution, thus giving UAB a first down and the chance to kneel the ball and take the game. So an interesting way for the Stockstills to go out, not including the bowl game, of course, but just a fantastic game. And from in terms of the on-the-field product, really could not have asked for a better way to end the Conference USA season, I think.
Yeah, Joe, I'm right there with you. It's like you're writing my notes, because the first thing I noted is that this one is exactly what you want to see out of your conference championship game. You know, this game should be, you know, the showcase, the representative sample of your conference, the two best teams, and you never want to have that game end in a blowout. Excuse me, especially if you're a G5. So not going to go ahead and bury the lead here. As you stated, heartbreaking way to lose the game for Middle Tennessee State. You know, when you have the too many men on the field, gives UAB the first down and the chance to, as you said, kneel on it and run the clock out. I saw that, you know, it was kind of made fun of a little bit on Monday Night Football with the come on, man, and whatnot. But things like that happen. I mean, I saw with FIU, they had a couple of times this year where they had a uniform violation. We saw a bizarre penalty in the FAU game. I believe it was 12. Oh, no, it wasn't 12 men on the field. They had two number fives on the field. So, I mean, things like that, especially on special teams, are going to happen. And unfortunately, it just happened at the worst time for Middle Tennessee State. You mentioned Tyler Johnston, and you kind of talked about the game that he played. I'm going to go ahead and just drive it in here. He played an A.J. Erdley type game. You know, he just made the passes that were there. He did have the one interception, but he made the plays that were there that needed to be made and didn't lose it for his team. Like you said, picked up yards on the ground. And as always, who deserves mentioning is Spencer Brown, because he had a typical Spencer Brown type game. Back to form, obviously, last week he was only able to take the one carry before missing the rest of that contest. But back to form with the 31 carries for 156 yards. That's just a typical Spencer Brown workhorse type day for him. Getting the job done. And yeah, you know, either way, it was going to be an emotional loss. UAB coming back from the dead as a program, and then you have Middle Tennessee State. It's the last one at home for the Stockstills together. I love that picture. I'm sure you've seen it. If you haven't seen it at home, you got to find a way to see that picture of Brent Stockstill and Rick together on the sideline when he's like a seventh grader, and they always compose that. They compare that to them being on the sidelines together. I love that shot. But just a really emotional loss. And if you saw Rick Stockstill post game, just talking about how much he really wanted it for his kids, and I think that's huge to note, because you get a lot of coaches sometimes who you can tell they want to win, but it's for their own ego. You know, they want to win to say, hey, you know, I did this. With Rick Stockstill, you can tell he really wanted this one for his kids, and it's a tough way to lose. But hey, give credit to UAB, and they are the Conference USA champions.
Yeah, they end the season 10-3 before they head to the bowl game here. But you mentioned this, the emotion in the Stock Stills press conference after losing the game in that way, and it was just, understandably so, just such a crazy contrast of emotion between, you know, that locker room and then shooting over to UAB's, and it's just pure joy, pure elation, giving everything those kids have gone through. So, you know, two sides of the coin there, I guess. But yeah, workhouse Spencer Brown and the UAB Blazers getting it done. What a fantastic year for them.
Absolutely. And their head coach, you know, talk about another head coach, Bill Clark, he was rightly rewarded postgame for his efforts.
Yeah, yeah. Bill Clark getting the contract extension, as Eric notes here. New deal running through 2024. We'll pay him $1.45 million and could go up to $1.65 million. Kind of seems like the natural move here. Just with how he's been able to elevate this program, given the adversity that, you know, the Alabama school system, who is now paying him more money, given how he kind of fought through the barriers that they put in his way, and how the program did that in general, and how he kind of, you know, took these kids and turned them into champions. So I think this is a great move by them. Very well deserved by Mr. Clark, and I can obviously see this working out. And it comes at a great time too, obviously, when you know, we see G5 coaches trying to make the jump to a bigger and better job. But I think this is going to be enough to kind of keep the Blazers coach from getting poached from you know, another big program who might be getting rid of their coach every, you know, pretty soon.
Yeah, and let me apologize to my co-host. I kind of whiffed and forgot that we had one more game, so I kind of jumped ahead. Just a little, inadvertent programming note there. But with Bill Clark, here's my major takeaway. And you kind of touched on it, Joe. You mentioned the Alabama school system. Once again, you know, for those of you listening, there have been plenty of stories written. I just a quick Google search and get the job done, because the amount of time that we have here won't do it justice. The short way I can say this is Alabama's king and everyone else falls in second place. So it's the reason that when Jimbo Fisher was up for the job, the funds weren't necessarily there. The phrase "the funds aren't there" isn't new regarding the Alabama school system and football. That's not UAB. So all those things considered, Bill Clark really gets the contract extension that he deserves. Because he stayed with the program when they went dark, leads the team to a conference title, and now he's the league's highest paid coach. And like you said, in this day and age, when you have coaches jumping to the next best thing, both sides really showed loyalty to each other. And I just love it for him personally, because like I said, you know, he stayed with the program when you know, he had just taken the job when the program went dark. And he could have easily said, hey, you know, I've got a family to feed and I'm going to, you know, go to the next best thing. But he stayed with it and he's being rewarded. So great job there.
Absolutely. I think this this deal still needs to be approved by the University of Alabama System Board of Trustees, but I don't really see a reason why this wouldn't get pushed through, because I think if there's one thing that we've learned from everything that UAB has accomplished and everything they've gone through, the funds are in fact there. So I think they'll be fine. But you mentioned that we have one more game to go through, and there's not too much to really say about it. That was Marshall heading to Virginia Tech for the regular season finale. And we both picked Marshall to win this game. Definitely thought they were going to be able to hang with a Hokie team that's struggled for most of the season. And that was not the case, really. Got some points in garbage time to finish up this game 41-20. And Mr. Brendan Knox certainly deserves a tip of the hat for 27 carries, 204 yards, and 2 touchdowns. But really, aside from that individual performance, this was not the way we expected Marshall to perform, when they really could have had a chance to get their 9th win of the season and, you know, do something that would have put kind of a little smirk on, I think, a lot of G5 football's faces as they deny a P5 team bowl eligibility. But again, that didn't happen. So Hokies walk away with that one, finish the year 6-6, and Marshall wrapping up the regular season 8-4. So that's that game.
Yeah, Joe. Both of us, as you mentioned, we both did pick Marshall to win that game. And for me, it was really a disappointing performance because, as I mentioned last week on the podcast, this isn't the Virginia Tech team of 1999 with Michael Vick and Frank Beamer, and, you know, they're not competing for national championships. They allowed Ryan Willis to look like Peyton Manning back there. You know, he's a guy who, if you follow his career, you know, from the time he was at Kansas, he was pedestrian at best. And this game actually statistically was the best of his career, and it came against a very solid Marshall defense. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, Ryan Willis isn't any better than James Morgan, so just a disappointment to see that type of regression. But, you know, you touched on Brendan Knox. I think the key takeaway there, if you're a Marshall fan, is, you know, you've got a really nice player, and that's going to be a great deal coming back next year with he and Tyler King in the backfield along with Isaiah Green. So you definitely have that to look forward to. But the second quarter, the game really got away from the herd, and that caused their downfall. But I'll get a chance to see them as I'll be covering the Gasparilla Bowl, in which they'll be taking on the University of South Florida here in Tampa. So I'll get a chance to see just what exactly happened with Marshall and if they can rebound against a pretty solid USF team.
Covering the Gasparilla Bowl, that's got to be your least stressful travel day of the year.
Yeah. That was compared to the four-hour drive to Miami, it was definitely my least stressful game when I covered the USF-UCF. So I'll be more than happy to make the drive up to Raymond James Stadium, which is 3.1 miles away from the doorstep I am at right now.
Yeah, so that'll be a fun time. And we'll get to the bowl stuff soon enough. But for right now, let's jump into some coaching news. So with Charlotte, we thought the 49ers had their guy in Mike Houston. Basically what happened is he said, I will accept the offer, but I want to still interview for other jobs. And Charlotte said, no, not really how that works, and rescinded the job offer. So since Mike Houston, formerly the James Madison head coach, had quite a bit of success there at the FCS level, will now take over the helm at East Carolina. And Charlotte, I believe, has found their guy, though, right, Eric?
Yes. I have been checking Twitter right up until we started taping this, and it's Will Leahy is going to be the guy. He is the former head man at Austin Peay. I knew I was going to say it that way. It's Austin Peay. Dear God. He's former head man at Austin Peay. He's 33 years old, from that area. I believe he's a native of Chattanooga, Tennessee. They've got a nice young head coach and an awesome P program that had really struggled prior to this. The year before last, they won 8 games. This year, I believe they went 5-6, if my memory serves me correct. But nice young head coach, nice young hire in terms of offensive mind. They do have their guy.
It's interesting. I think with that hire, one of the things a lot of us were kind of hoping Charlotte would do was hire someone with deep ties to the area to kind of get these local kids excited about football, and they go another way. Not that I don't think this guy is a decent coach, because it takes a lot to kind of take a program like Austin Peay, who kind of had a losing tradition for a while, and elevate them to the point where they had an 8-win season and they were competitive again. But I think that's an interesting choice on their part to go away from the whole hire a local guy and bring the recruiting to the next level thing, which I think a lot of people were hoping they would do.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head right there, because someone who I thought really would have been a great hire is Pep Hamilton. You know, Will Leahy, as I said, is 33 years old. Pep Hamilton is 44, if my memory serves me correctly again on that one. So, you know, sure, I guess you do have a little bit of an age difference there, but still a younger guy, and, you know, played at West Charlotte in high school. All the fans, when I made the trip to Charlotte to cover the Charlotte FIU game, the feedback that we all got when it was announced that Brad Lambert would be fired is they wanted someone who could recruit the Charlotte area very well. So, you know, they go a different direction. We'll see how it works. Something I did want to run by you, and as far as Mike Houston goes, the only thing I've got is don't hate the player, hate the game. Mike Hill and Charlotte got played. There's no two ways about it, and I'm not mad at Mike Houston. You know, that's using leverage and negotiation, and hey, sure, more power to him. But just really quick, Joe, I haven't been to Greenville in 4 years. I went for the UCF-ECU game in 2014. Just your quick opinion. Do you think ECU is a better job than Charlotte?
You know, that's a tough question. I think ECU, given their history and how they were pretty competitive fairly recently, you know, on the national level – Short answer, yeah, I think the East Carolina job is a little bit better just with the history. I think there's a little more money and maybe a little more, you know, not maybe more fan support, but I think with it's just differing levels, if that makes sense. Charlotte fan support right now is just nothing but is just so pessimistic and frustrated and just wanting to get to the point where there's some level of success because they've never had it. Whereas thanks to the past success of East Carolina, there's that fan support of wanting to get back and, you know, wanting to return to form, really. So I think with the tradition that kind of is rooted in that program and what that means for recruiting, along with, you know, kind of knowing that landscape a little bit, things like it being a high priority for, like, Adidas. Like, East Carolina is, you know, up there in terms of G5s, in terms of getting good stuff. And I think in terms of the recruiting draw that it can be, I think it's a little bit better of a situation there. And also, you know, I'm not sure what Mike Houston's sensibilities are, but, you know, Greenville, Carolina, and just the whole coastal part of North and South Carolina in general is gorgeous. So I think if you're looking for that as opposed to, you know, living in a city, not that there's anything wrong with Charlotte specifically, but just living in a city in general, you know, I would take the beach any day.
Now, you know, Joe, I think you made an excellent point, something that didn't even cross my mind as someone who grew up in Tampa and lived in, went to grad school in Chicago. Sensibilities and things of that nature are really good points I think you've made there. Charlotte, while it is, you know, it's not quite in Atlanta in terms of a big city like a metropolis, it is still a bigger city than Greenville, so great point. All I was going to say in terms of comparing ECU versus Charlotte is maybe I'm biased because I, you know, I'm having some recency bias because I just went to Charlotte. I think if you put, you know, Chris Reynolds, Ben LeMay, Victor Tucker, Rico Arnold together, and sure, you don't want to think in the short term as a coach, you want to think for the long term success. But I think that Will Healy, and I was saying Will Leahy, I apologize, it's Will Healy, they're going to win 7 games at minimum next year because the defense was already in place. Yes, they will lose Juwan Foggy, but they'll still return a lot of talent. Offensively, they just need someone to get something going. So I guess when I look at the essentially where East Carolina has been since they fired Ruffin McNeil has just been abysmal. And I look at that, in my opinion, Charlotte, when you look at the facilities and the talent they have, is trending in the right direction. I look at them as on par. But as you mentioned as well, you know, when I was a student at UCF, ECU was like the biggest rival. It was ECU and Memphis in terms of being neck and neck for competing for for American Athletic Championships when they had, you know, the talent that they had in terms of Justin Hardy and guys like that. So, yeah, I mean, maybe in terms of recent success, ECU does a little more history.
Yeah, I remember my freshman year of college, they opened the season against South Carolina. And both of those teams are ranked in the top 25, if I'm not mistaken. So it's hasn't been that long, right? but yeah, I think just to sum up what I said, I think East Carolina is a slightly better situation right now. We'll see where that new coach is able to elevate that job to in the next couple years, because we might not have the same opinion when we're still doing the show, obviously, in 4 years or 2 years or whatever. Yeah, so we'll see what happens with that. Other coaching news, we've talked a little bit about in the past about Seth Luttrell and the success that he's had at North Texas possibly being something that would attract P5 job offers, and it's, you know, certainly been a huge topic of conversation in the past, but it's looking like he is the front runner for this Kansas State job with Bill Snyder now retiring. But I think from what I understand, our own Dakota Gregory down in Denton doing a journalism, as they say, and getting some good information that he's not ruling it out, but I don't think he's necessarily leaning towards leaving for Kansas State, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you know, Dakota does a great job, you know, for Underdog Dynasty and all of us. As far as covering North Texas, he always does a phenomenal job. But yeah, here's where just, you know, my quick thoughts. I got to put my biases aside as a fan of G5 football. We'll get into this topic a little bit at the end of the show, but you know, I'm going to bounce something off you at the end here. While I sincerely hope that Seth Littrell stays at North Texas, if your aspirations as a head coach are to have a chance to compete at the highest level, and the highest level meaning a national championship or the college football playoff, you have to make the jump. UCF is indicative of that. You know, they've won a bazillion straight games, and they don't even have a realistic chance of making the playoff. Like I said, we'll touch on that in a little bit. If your aspirations are building a winner and being successful, I think you have to stay. In terms of money, let's look at Lane Kiffin. I'm going to use the FAU job as an example. They came up with some pretty creative ways to fund his contract. So all things considered, unless it's a Texas or an Oklahoma where they just have, you know, like that oil money and they can just, you know, toss $50 million at someone like it's nothing, the money Lane Kiffin earns in Boca is pretty relative, all things considered, to the way they've shaped that contract, to what he could get at definitely a Kansas State. You know, Kansas State is necessarily going to break the bank. So that's just kind of my thoughts on Seth Littrell. I mean, Bill Snyder's done a phenomenal job. He's been there, you know, this is his second tour of duty at Kansas State. And Kansas State is a nice job. But even when he was winning the first time, when you and I were, you know, in elementary school, Kansas State was kind of looked at as how are they doing this, you know? I remember one of the first players to kind of introduce me to college football was a guy named Michael Bishop, who was a great college quarterback at Kansas State. But it was almost looked at as like, all right, you know, they're that team that once every 5 years could have that nice group of seniors who's been together for 4 years and go on a run. But Kansas State isn't a program that's going to realistically compete for a national title anytime soon, and I don't think they ever will. My apologies to Wildcat fans. You know, they're not they're what I have gotten into debates with SEC fans is they're like the Vanderbilt of their conference in the sense that, yes, they're there because that's their birthright, and you know, they have that right to compete at a Power Five level, but when it comes down to, you know, all things considered, they're not really going to compete for a national championship. So if it's that's why I make the point about money. If it's a money thing, you know, hey, I am a capitalist. Go get your money. Do what you got to do. And if you think that you have a better chance to compete for a national championship, I guess you have to make the move. But if your aspirations are just building a winner and being successful, I think you should stay at North Texas.
What do you get? You're ruining the huge contingency of Kansas State fans that listen to this show, Eric.
My apologies, Wildcat fans. I'll go out and, you know, buy a bright purple shirt and I'll wear an ugly uniform when he says.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with you, though. I don't know that Kansas State is one of those jobs that's going to make people, you know, jump out of their seat. Especially when, like, I don't know, there's not a ton of winning tradition there, but it's tough to kind of follow up a guy like Bill Snyder who had been there for so long. And, you know, you don't even know necessarily how well you're going to be embraced at a P5 job when you're coming from a North Texas or, you know, any G5 job, really. But I think Seth Littrell he's built a good little spot for himself there in Denton. And I really don't see any reason why he wouldn't be happy there, aside from obviously a bigger paycheck. But it doesn't seem like, in terms of getting on the field results, I don't think K-State would be the best place to go. You know what I mean? So I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, they did that before with now the guy I'm staring at him right in the face and I cannot remember his name, who took over right after Bill Snyder. I don't want to say the name Ron Prince and it's not him. While I'm rambling, I'll try to find the name. But I'm making that point is to say that, you know, Bill Snyder was really the exception to the rule in terms of getting things done at Kansas State. It's the reason why they named the damn stadium after him and why they brought him back again when it didn't work out when he left. And if it's a quality of life thing, forgive me, you know, I guess I'm really not going to, you know, endear myself to Kansas State fans. Why the hell would I want to be in Manhattan, Kansas? So it can't be a quality of life thing. And I think there's creative things that UNT can do with the contract to make the things, all things considered, relative. So just my thoughts there as far as the Kansas State job.
Sure. And I think the other thing that was sort of attractive to
Latrell about the North Texas job is the fact that it's a little – it's relatively close to his hometown in Oklahoma, as our own Dakota Gregory pointed out in his article on UDD that's up right now. You should go read it. And Manhattan, Kansas is about 100 miles further than that. So, I mean, if that's really something that's super important to him, it doesn't seem like the stars are really aligning here. But never say never, I guess.
Sure, yeah. And just real quick, I just want to clean up that point. It was Ron Prince, who was at Kansas State, okay, went 7-6, 5-7, and 5-7, and was fired. So it just goes to show you, if you're not Bill Snyder, there's not much success to be had at K-State.
Not really, no. They called Bill Snyder the wizard for a reason. I'm trying to think if, like, he looks like some fantasy character that I can't put my finger on, but he might just look like every old man ever, and I don't. Oh well. Someone.
All right. The Kansas State fans will definitely be filling up our emails.
I mean, he had a good body of work at Kansas State. We can't really. It takes a special kind of guy to coach at a P5 program for as long as he did, and he had a winning record. He was 2-10 and 1-10. So that's not bad, you know what I mean? He was AP Coach of the Year in 1998, won several other Coach of the Year awards along the way. You can't discount what the guy did at Kansas State. If there are any Kansas State fans listening to the show at all, I don't know why I feel the need to defend making fun of Bill Snyder at this point. But whatever. Anyway, I think the other kind of minor note that we don't have to go too into right now is we know that Tyson Helton is going to keep on Western Kentucky defensive coordinator Clayton White for a few more go-rounds, at least, keeping on several position coaches as well, including offensive line coach TJ Woods and a few other defensive folks. But I think kind of bringing in some other offensive people to kind of rejuvenate that Hilltopper offense that kind of needs a little kick in the rear right now, if you ask me. But
I'll make my note really quick on that. Mm-hmm. If you're Western Kentucky, how many people can you afford to pay? You can't fire one guy and then say, hey, you know, I would think that if you're Western Kentucky and you're bringing someone on, you're going to say, hey, you're going to have to keep a couple of assistants, and that's that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, I get the decision for the most part, and I think some of the guys that they're keeping on have, they've done a fairly good job with what they have in terms of the, you know, the players and the matchups that they've had to go up against this year or the last couple years with the amount of with just the amount of really good quarterbacks and high quality offensive players that are in this league. But hopefully this is the start of something good with a little bit of new and a little bit of old with Western Kentucky football right now. And then before we get into the bowl schedule in general, the only Conference USA team, I believe, to not get a bowl invite, even though they were bowl eligible, Southern Miss. So that's a thing. You have any opinion on that, Eric?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. Forgive me for, you know, sounding like some, you know, 60-year-old man here when I'm in my mid-20s, but not everyone should go to a bowl game, in my opinion. I know we're at this point where there's so many bowls and you automatically think, boom, you know, 6 wins means we're going somewhere, but I don't have a huge issue with the Golden Eagles not qualifying because I think, you know, we're almost at the point where we're watering down, you know, the schedule and just 6 wins, all right, boom, bowl game. No issue at all that they didn't qualify for a bowl game.
What has it always been? It hasn't always been 6 wins for a bowl game.
Correct. It hasn't always been 6 wins. I wish I knew the exact reason off the top of my head. I believe that it was after the BCS went into effect in 98.
I see.
Because it affected the way the national champion was awarded. Then that became the qualifier for 6. Don't hold me to that, but I believe that's the reason why. That was the reason why.
Gotcha. I know Conference USA only has so many bowl bids, so it's kind of natural that someone was going to get left out. It happened to UTSA last year, but, you know, the only thing I'll say is it had to happen to somebody, There's a small part of me that's a little surprised no one wanted Southern Miss, especially one of the smaller bowl games in the southeastern part of the country. We give Southern Miss fans, you know, we make fun of them, deservedly so sometimes, for, you know, thinking that there's, you know, certain feelings towards their team when there aren't. But one thing I admire about that fan base is they're very passionate and they love that team. And I think if they had gotten an invite to a bowl that was within a relatively easy travel distance, that bowl game would have made money. You know what I mean? So I think that's just a little surprising. I'm not losing sleep over it or anything, but I think it's a little surprising that no one jumped in a bowl game for them, considering the fact that that would have been a good opportunity to sell tickets with how passionate and Southern Miss fans travel relatively well.
No, yeah. I mean, I'm staring at the bowl schedule right now, and the only one that I could have conceivably said that would have been a good fit would have been the New Orleans Bowl. Does the New Mexico Bowl? No. The Boca Raton Bowl? Not really. The Gasparilla Bowl is just a better fit with the teams they have in now, specifically USF playing at home, even though the local paper here speculated that they might not be able to have a good showing at home, but I digress. The Bahamas Bowl? No. And the Hawaii Bowl? No. So it would have had to have been the New Orleans Bowl otherwise, and I think they have a much better fit, quite frankly, in Middle Tennessee and Appalachian State. So.
Sure. Sure. So with that, we'll just dive into the bowl schedule and kind of give our quick thoughts on some of these matchups, and then we will do a formal bowl preview show next week. But the first one, North Texas, Utah State in the New Mexico Bowl on the 15th, Middle Tennessee and Appalachian State that same day in the New Orleans Bowl. And then on the 18th of December, UAB in Northern Illinois go at it in the Boca Raton Bowl. Marshall and South Florida in the Gasparilla Bowl, as you mentioned you were going to on the 20th. On the 21st, FIU and Toledo in the Bahamas Bowl. And then wrapping it up with Hawaii and Louisiana Tech in the Hawaii Bowl on December 22nd. So any of those matchups jump out at you for any particular reason, Eric?
Yeah, for one, the Gasparilla Bowl, and once again, it's just complete bias because, you know, I'm born and raised in Tampa, and it's where I am now. Mm-hmm. USF, they better do something in a hurry because, you know, Joe, even though we cover Conference USA, we're fans of college football. USF started season 7-0. Mm-hmm. Charlie Strong made that point many times in his radio show here in Tampa. They still are sitting on 7 wins. So they better do something in a hurry, if not to lose all interest in that program here in Tampa. The Bahamas Bowl, I want to see how FIU can respond. Obviously, I cover FIU. And James Morgan has played against Toledo in his career when he was at Bowling Green. Actually had one of his better games as a Falcon against Toledo. So interested in that. And definitely want to see how Middle Tennessee can bounce back in the New Orleans Bowl.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm interested. I think the best game will end up being North Texas, Utah State. I think North Texas has a pretty decent shot to win that game, especially with. Do we know if Utah State's coach is gonna? Because he just got hired at Texas Tech, right?
Yeah, and I haven't. I actually was looking for that pre-show, and I wasn't able to see whether he still will be there or not.
I think that'll be an interesting matchup just because we've seen a lot of good things out of both of those teams so far this year. Obviously, want to see if UAB can correct the mistakes that they made last year when they played a MAC team in a bowl game and kind of laid an egg. Would be nice to see them kind of wrap up the year on a high note. And then, I don't know. I think the Hawaii Bowl will be interesting. Like, Hawaii had some really great offensive production in the beginning of this year and then kind of became more inconsistent as the year went on. And, you know, Louisiana Tech is kind of a similar story. There's some really good offensive talent on that team, and then obviously some pretty decent defensive talent too with Jalen Ferguson. But consistency issues were there as well. So I think that will be a really interesting game. And it's a pretty good time slot, I think. Well, I take that back. It's a good time slot for the West Coast.
for the West Coast.
Yeah, not for the East Coast. That's going to be at 10:30 Eastern time on Saturday, December 22nd. But I think some of these games are going to be relatively interesting. It's we got two games against MAC opponents, two against Sun Belt opponents, one against a Mountain West, two against Mountain West, and then one against a MAC team. So I think that's, or no, one against an American team, sorry.
Yeah, you get, an American, you got one Sun Belt team, if I am correct. Because we got two against the MAC, and then two against the WAC, yeah.
Okay, yeah, no, you're right. Okay. Okay, yeah, you're better at this than I am. Okay, so yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see if, because last year, I don't think Conference USA had a very good record in bowl games. I think Mountain West kind of dominated from the G5 perspective last bowl season in terms of actually winning games. So I think this is going to be an interesting opportunity for Conference USA, just with the amount of teams that once again qualified. And I think there's some pretty decent matchups in here. I don't think any of these games are favored by either team is favored by more than 9 points, which is interesting. But then again, if you're scheduling a bowl game, you're obviously not going to try to put together a game that's going to be a blowout. So
I don't know. No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, just looking at him, you know, I'm staring at him right here on my computer, and I think we have some fairly solid matchups here. You know, like I said, we'll get into predictions and whatnot next week, but I think we've got some fairly solid matchups.
With the playoff discussion happening right now, we just found out that the four teams will be Notre Dame, Alabama, Clemson, and Oklahoma. And even after UCF winning 25 straight games and two conference titles, not really that close to actually being considered for the playoff, which for G5 football fans is disappointing. And Eric, this is kind of your topic, so I'll let you have the floor. But what is the standard for a G5 to actually be considered for the college football playoff? Because with how well UCF's done and to only get this far, you know, what is it that a G5 even has to do, if anything, to actually get into the college football playoff at this point?
Yeah, Joe. So this is one I really wanted to touch on, and I promise I won't take up too much time. But just here's my frustration, and it's not even as, you know, a graduate at UCF. You know, I promise you, for those listening at home, don't, you know, eyes glaze over. This is not a does UCF deserve to be in a playoff debate. That's been played out long before. This is a what the hell does a G5 have to do to get legitimate consideration? Even if you think, even if you think that they are not one of the top four teams, because every year is going to be different. I'm completely okay with that. But I think that Joe and I will agree here, and obviously I'll leave him the floor to finish up. UCF didn't really get serious consideration. And if you look at the coaches poll, USA Today did publish the coaches poll. The only coaches who voted UCF in the top four were Rick Stockstill, who ironically enough was a former UCF assistant in the 80s, and Troy Calhoun at Air Force. So that just kind of goes to show you, when you talk about the people who are voting on this in terms of the playoff committee and whatnot, I think that's a fair representative sample of what they kind of think of G5 football. And we can get into a debate as far as, you know, the way UCF has chosen to go about it in terms of Danny White being very public. And I was there postgame. He was very public about his thoughts about it being a not fair system, and that a better system needs to be devised. But just the standard in general is very frustrating to me, because this is what I sent you, you know, when I talked about doing this topic, was if you win 25 straight games in a row and two conference titles and you can't get serious consideration for, hey, this team deserves a shot at four. I'm not expecting a G5 to come in number one or number two or number three. I expect that. And we can get into a different debate as to whether the playoff needs to be expanded to eight. But I just think that what message are you sending to G5 football when you win your conference twice? You win it outright. In terms of UCF, they won it with their backup quarterback, having lost arguably one of the best players in school history. And they've beaten Auburn last year. So they've shown that, hey, you put us up there against the quote-unquote big boys and we can hang. What more do you expect? And this is also the last point I want to make. I did a roundtable for Underdog Dynasty, did it about last week, and we did a topic as far as G5 versus P5 football in the state of Florida and how the P5s are really struggling where the G5s are doing well. And Jeff Sharon of the Black and Gold Banner Array, which is SB Nation's UCF site, made a great point, and I'm going to run this one by you as well, Joe. When the scholarship limits were reduced from 100 to 85 in the early 90s, that means that there's now less scholarships available and way more talent, you know, needed to fill those scholarships. Mm-hmm. So in the past 25 years, that talent's going to trickle down and have to go elsewhere. And that's resulted with a myriad of other things in G5 football teams just becoming better. So this isn't, you know, 1985 where, like, you know, Northern Illinois would win 8 games, but they're playing, you know, Little Sisters of the Poor and we just send them to any old bowl game. Joe, you know, take kids like Devin Singletary or Daryl Henderson from Memphis. These aren't inferior football players. These are players who, if you put them out there on that stage, can compete. So I just can't see a reasonable argument as to, you know, if you want to make the strength of schedule argument all you want, all right, fine. Then you win 25 straight. But what else, what is the standard for a G5 to get a reasonable consideration? I don't know. So my rant is over. I'll let you close it up.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head on most of this stuff. I honestly think until we get an expanded, expanded playoff where we allow, the best G5 in like an 18 playoff. I think one of the more popular things is, you know, all the P5 conference champs, the best G5, and then two at larges. I think that's – until we get a system like that, I legitimately don't believe we're going to see a G5 team in the playoff. It just – with the way that the selection committee seems to, you know, explain away their selection criteria and all this stuff, I just don't think it's going to happen. It's just – as sad as it is to say, it's a really frustrating thing to see with – how hard these kids work and, you know, how well they've done. Obviously UCF's the prime example of just really running through every roadblock people have put in their way in terms of opponents, in terms of like branding and resources and all that. It, for whatever reason, it's just not, I don't know what they have to do, because every argument that you could throw out there of really like why they don't deserve to at least be considered, is just not, it's doesn't really hold very much weight anymore, because we've seen them do everything that really they can possibly do. And I it's sad to say, but I don't think we're going to see a G5 team actually make the playoffs in the 4-team system.
Yeah, you know, just my thoughts, and I want to make sure I get this on the record that this is perfectly clear. This is not a UCF or even an American thing. I think most of us would agree that the American probably is kind of sets the standard as far as G5 football, as far as having, you know, good teams. But I don't care if it's the MAC, if it's the Mountain West, if it's the Sun Belt. In my opinion, if South Alabama or Appalachian State won 25 straight games and 2 conference titles, they deserve to at least have legitimate consideration to make the college football playoff. And as you said, until we get an expanded format, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah, so it's a sad state of affairs, but hopefully we'll see some change coming down the pipeline in the next couple of years in order to give these athletes a fair chance. But with that, we will go ahead and wrap up this week's show. Thank you so much for listening. Go ahead and subscribe to the Underdog Podcast on iTunes if you haven't already. I promise those shows will start showing up on iTunes more frequently now. And follow at Underdog Dynasty on Twitter. Like us on Facebook. Check out UnderdogDynasty.com every day for more G5 football goodness. You can follow both of us on social media as well. I am at @JOEHIO_. Eric is @EricCHenry_. And come be part of the discussion with us as we get prepped for bowl season and come back next week as we dive into that a little bit more. With that, have a great weekend. Happy football watching, everybody. We'll